Yes.
I think it's a tall person.
I think it's a tall person.
Yeah. The House Committee on Revenue for February 17, 2009 will come to order. We have an exciting morning planned, colleagues, today. We're going to hear, do a public hearing on two bills, House Bill 2069 and House Bill 2471. We'll open the hearing on both bills. Chris?
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. In your packet, you have a one-pager, two-sided, that provides a little bit of background on medical deductions, and so I thought it would be worthwhile to just to take a couple of minutes and try to avoid some confusion and talk about medical deductions in general. And so that's what that handout does. Basically, at the federal level, those who itemize their deductions are allowed to claim an itemized deduction for medical expenses that exceed 7.5% of their AGI. So there is no age requirement, and examples of eligible expenses are pretty much anything that is medical or dental related that is not reimbursed through insurance or some other means, so any out-of-pocket expenses. And so that's an itemized deduction at the federal level.
And that includes the insurance premium itself, doesn't it?
Insurance premiums, if you pay for them, yes.
Yeah.
That can be in there. And so medical insurance premiums, any other hospital services, hearing aids, chiropractor services, contact lenses, glasses, all of those things can go into that pot. The deduction, though, is only for expenses in excess of 7.5% of AGI. So, for example, if a taxpayer has $100,000 of income, that threshold is $7,500. So the deduction is only for those expenses that exceed $7,500. No deduction is allowed for the expenses up to that 7.5 demarcation. And so note that that is tied to income. So if you have an individual with $10,000 of income, their threshold is $750 of medical expenses. So then they could deduct anything above $750. But, of course, they have a lot less income to reduce before they would hit down to zero by extreme medical expenses. Now, Oregon law, as we're tied to federal federal definition of taxable income, we tie to that deduction as well. And so for those Oregonians who itemize their deductions, they get that same medical deduction. It's just whatever was claimed on the federal return gets claimed on the Oregon return. So all Oregonians, if they itemize their return, can claim a deduction for medical expenses in excess of 7.5% of AGI. The policy that is addressed in 2069 and 2471 is the so-called additional medical deduction. And this is for taxpayers who are currently age 62 or over. They are allowed to deduct medical expenses up to that 7.5% of AGI. So essentially that amount that they are not allowed to claim through the federal law. And so essentially people 62 and over can deduct all of their medical expenses. And it would be through two pieces, either through the connection to the federal law for the itemized deductions, or this additional medical deduction for the elderly. So those are the two pieces, and that's how they fit together. So I have a couple of charts that show some of the history of the medical deduction, and the first one there is the total medical deduction claim since 1991, which is when the policy was implemented. And we can see over the 15 years here, the deduction has grown from just under $200 million a year to $675 million a year in 2006. And so it has a pretty steady growth rate throughout the 90s. It levels off a little bit in the 01 and 02 and then takes off again at a much faster rate since 2003. The next chart down there, the bar chart, shows a little bit of the underlying patterns as to some of that growth and why it was so steady throughout the 90s. When the policy was passed in 1991, originally, it was for taxpayers age 58 and over, and it was gradually increased to age 62. Every other year, the age was increased by one. And so what we see in those bar charts are those average, or the annual growth rates in the number of claimants. So in 93, the number of claimants grew 5% from 1992, and then in 1994, it grew another 4%. And in 1995, it was pretty much flat. It only grew by 1%, and that's because the age increased from 59 to age 60. So that helped mitigate the growth in the deduction. And then we see in 1996, when the age was held steady at 60, the growth was upwards of 6%. And then in 1997, the age increased by 1 year, and so the growth was down again at around 1%. And so that's that pattern throughout the 90s that helped to keep the growth of it fairly constant. It mitigated some of the growth in medical expenses. And then since 1999, the age has been 62. And we can see the growth rates since that time, where the most part, except for the recession years, the growth was around 6% in total deduction claimed. So if you turn the page over, another piece as to the driver of the deduction is the average medical deduction. And we see here, going from 1991 to 2006, that average deduction grew from just under $2,000 to roughly $3,400 over that time. And again, fairly constant growth throughout the 90s, and it picked up again in the most recent years. And that will be a function of a couple of things. There'll be medical inflation that's in there, but it will also be a function of the income, because it is tied to 7.5% of income. As incomes increase, the amount of deduction will increase because of that 7.5% demarcation. The next chart there, that bar chart, provides a distribution for tax year 2006 of the claimants. The lighter bars are the number of claimants, and we can see that it's more concentrated at the lower end of taxpayers. The darker bar is the amount of deduction, and that's concentrated at the high end. And again, that's going to be a function of income, because it's all driven by that 7.5% of AGI. And so the top three bars on the right, for the folks at $100,000 and over, a third of the deduction is claimed by those folks. The last piece, which gets us to the two bills in front of you, are two policy changes to that deduction. House Bill 2069 puts a cap at the amount of deduction that can be claimed, and that in the bill is at $6,000, and it is adjusted for inflation. What that $6,000 deduction translates to in AGI terms is $80,000. So individuals who have AGI up to $80,000 could claim their full additional medical deduction under current law. For tax filers with AGI of $80,000 or more, they'll be claiming the $6,000 deduction, provided they have the medical expenses. And the bill takes the revenue and puts it into a senior and disabled services account. And the bill has that effective date of January 1, 2009. And the preliminary revenue impact for 2009-11 is $23 million. House Bill 2471 is taken from Measure 30 and phases it out for individuals. It also raises the age from 62 to 65 over 3 years. It's effective 1-1-2010. And then the phase-out schedule is in that table there below. And basically, for joint filers below $30,000 of income, they'd be able to claim the full deduction still. For those between $30,000 and $60,000, they could claim 40% of the deduction. You would calculate it the same way, then there would just be a percentage, that how much they would be allowed to take. And then for those between $60,000 and $80,000, they would get 20%. $80,000 to $100,000 would get 10%, and over $100,000, no deduction would be allowed. And that revenue impact for 2009-11 is $43 million. Now, that is a one-year impact, so a biennial impact would be, using ballpark numbers, about $85 million or $90 million.
Representative Gelser.
Thank you. So just to clarify, under the Oregon law, the taxpayer must be 62 or older in order to benefit.
Correct.
From the Oregon tax, regardless of whether or not they have extraordinary medical costs.
This is just the 7.5%.
Correct.
If they have extraordinary and they can itemize, then they are claiming a medical deduction, but not through this piece, through tying to the federal law.
Correct. I understand that. I'm just wondering what the policy intent was of the legislature to choose people based on age rather than based on the burden of medical expense to their family. So, for example, we heard a bill yesterday in the health care committee about children who are forced into foster care. Their parents are forced to live in poverty in order to be eligible for Medicaid. Why weren't those costs involved when those medical costs are swamping and bankrupting and forcing those families apart? What's the difference between being over 62 and being 15 and having medical costs destroy your family?
We might start with when this bill was, when this law was put into effect, and you probably have it in here.
It was in 1991. was when it became effective. And I believe it was part of some other discussions going on at the time. It was part of an overall package of other tax law changes that occurred at that time. I don't know how 50 it was chosen, although that might have been tied to some other credits, I think, taken at the time. There was a retirement credit. It might have been tied up with some PERS discussion, retirement income discussion.
Oh, there was a huge discussion then, wasn't there, about taxation of federal and state pensions.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I'm getting a nod from Paul. Okay.
So I think that's how the 50 was kind of tied to that policy as opposed to taken out.
And do you know what the total number of filers are that take advantage? I see the increase of the percentage, but the total number of taxpayers?
It's over 200,000. Okay. In 2006, it was 205,000.
Okay, thank you.
And I assume that these numbers are going to be going up dramatically because the baby boomers are going to reach this age, or some of us already have reached this age.
That's correct, Mr. Chair. And part of the, kind of tying in throughout the 90s, one of the mitigating factors was as that age was increased each year, the percent of eligible population, we had actually some declining years. Every time it increased a year, there was actually a decline in the percent of potential eligible population. In recent years, according to the most recent forecast, the growth in this population, age 62 and over, is right around 2% and 3%, and in 2009 increases to 5%, and it is greater than 4%. They're moving out. So that actually will accelerate some of the growth in the deduction because it increases the eligible population.
Thank you very much. Do we have people signed up to be heard today? I know of a couple. We have two members, Senator Burdick and Representative Cowan, who I know want to be heard. Would you like to be heard first? Why don't you come up?
We apparently aren't attuned to signing up. Sorry about that.
I think you assume that I know who you are.
Apologies, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, you better know who I am.
That's right.
Go ahead. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. You meet early in the morning. For the record, my name is Ginny Burdick, and I represent the people of Senate District 18 in Southwest Portland and Tigard. House Bill 2471 is actually a bill that I requested to be drafted and considered this year during this budget crunch. And my good colleague here will talk more in detail about some of the programs, some of the trade-offs that are involved here in terms of senior programs. I'm going to take a little bit more of a global approach because my motivation for doing this bill was the recognition that we have to think in this revenue climate, in this economic climate, we have to think very hard about every single penny we're spending, and we need to really consider things that we might be doing that we can no longer afford to do so that we can actually do the things that the most vulnerable Oregonians depend on, that our school children depend on, and things to protect public safety. So that's the spirit in which I went into this. And my purpose was to try to take a look at this program and take a hard look at who's actually benefiting from it and whether that is worth the subsidy, in effect, that other taxpayers are contributing toward this. And Representative Gelser's comments were really right on target. This was a program that was developed during the retirement, PERS retirement benefit taxation discussion some years ago. This was a little sweetener to help PERS retirees, as I understand it, and Paul can correct me if I'm wrong, but it was a sweetener to help shield PERS retirees from some extra costs that they might have because of the policy decision to tax retirement benefits. And that's why the age was set the way it was. Now, the chart that Chris described is to look at a different way. What we are doing with this medical deduction now is we are basically sending a check of about $20 million a year. This is based on 2006. We're taking $20 million a year off of the revenue table and sending it as a subsidy to people who make more than $100,000 a year to help pay for their medical costs. There is no such subsidy for low-income families with children. There is no such subsidy for seniors at lower income levels, because the deduction itself is worth very little for low-income seniors, because it's based on a percentage. I talked to the chairman earlier, and actually I would be very comfortable if the medical deduction were completely repealed, because I believe there are more effective ways to getting assistance to lower-income seniors who might get a little benefit from this bill. But if some of these funds were redirected and targeted more effectively, I believe there is a better way to get benefits to people who make $10,000 a year. These people can subtract a maximum of $750 from their taxes, which would yield a benefit of somewhere around $70. I believe there are more effective ways, less cumbersome ways, to get assistance to that group of seniors. But 2471 would be a good start, because at least it would focus, in a policy sense, it would focus the benefit to people at the lower income level. I think as we look at the budget, we have to consider an overall sense of fairness. I think we have to be fair to all elements in our society. Our communities want to be safe. Our children need to be in school. And our seniors need to be respected and taken care of as they try to live independently. And so when you have a $20 million subsidy for the richest of our seniors, then really that kind of comes out of that segment of money that you have available for other programs that might be better targeted for seniors, especially this year. The governor's, as everyone knows, the governor's budget is extremely, shall we say, stressful to senior programs. And it's the money that we get, the $20 million a year or more that we could get, just simply by not giving this benefit to people over $100,000, could be very well used in programs to keep seniors in their homes and to provide other benefits that low-income seniors need. So I hope the committee gives this serious consideration in a spirit of fairness. And I will also have to declare a reverse conflict of interest, because I will be one of the people who won't be able to do this anymore. I mean, I will qualify for the first time, and I'm hoping I don't get a chance to qualify, because I should not qualify for this benefit, and neither should others in my category, in my opinion, not when there are so many people suffering. So that's the reason I introduced this bill. And I look forward to working with you on it, and I hope you consider it favorably. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Why don't we hear from Representative Cowan, and then we'll take questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, I apologize for not signing up appropriately. For the record, I am Jean Cowan, and I'm the representative from House District 10, the Central Oregon Coast. What the staff is sharing with you is a copy of a bill that I'm working on to deliver services, and so I appreciate not only you hearing these two bills this morning, House Bill 2471 and 2069, and taking this hard look at our existing special medical exemption and its long-term impact on our system. But I also appreciate the chair's invitation to briefly share a little of my work that's focusing on the stabilization of Oregon's community-based long-term care system for seniors and people with physical disabilities. That's a whole lot of words to put into it, but frankly, if I shorten it to any one of those, then somebody's mad in the whole conversation. So we'll try to let you know about the collective effort. So since 2007, there really have been some very significant efforts to bring together all of those who share a passion for better addressing the needs of our valued older citizens. Now, this is something that I can go on at length about, but for today I'm going to spare you the soapbox lecture and try to focus just on the cost avoidance value of better helping those who are facing the challenges of finding appropriate long-term care for themselves or their families or their friends. I know in virtually every conversation I get into, this is coming very close to home for many, many people now who are experiencing these challenges within their own families. And I think that there are really two issues that we need to be talking about this session, and one is the obvious work that we have to do around maintaining some level of a delivery of the critical Medicaid services for this very vulnerable population. But it's also become increasingly obvious that we have to find a better way to sort of redirect the flow of an increasing number of individuals away from Medicaid-eligible services and those expensive skilled nursing home placements whenever that's possible. This effort is what brings me to the nexus between these two revenue bills and one of my bills, which relates to community-based long-term care, House Bill 2391. For virtually the entire 07-09 interim, I've been working to address the challenge of stabilizing our community-based long-term care system. And it's become clear that there's a need for assistance in helping people make better choices. Sometimes these situations just develop very suddenly within a family, and it's difficult to figure out what to do. Community-based options such as in-home care, assisted living facilities, adult foster care are often the most preferred, the most humane, the least expensive options available if skilled nursing home placement can be avoided or delayed. I'm sure that I don't have to tell you that for this pre-Medicaid population, such good choices can delay the expenditure or the depletion of one's nest egg. So the goal is to expand the Aging and Disability Resource Center concept, which is essentially an information and referral service for everyone. That would assure that a real person is there to answer telephone inquiries and to assist at a very difficult time. It'll also provide additional resources for Oregon Project Independence, family caregiver support, and chronic disease management programs. This redirection is really critical from a cost perspective view, particularly as we look at the demographic prospects that I know that you've previously looked at endlessly and the growth of this population of over 62 or 65, depending on which number you're looking at. It's my hope that we can join the resources projected from adjustments in the current special medical exemption through either bill. I actually would prefer a combination of the two. I like pieces of each one. And combine that with this opportunity to expand the assistance that we offer to individuals before they or a family member have exhausted their personal resources. This revenue source will provide an opportunity to move some funding from our wealthiest senior taxpayers, as Senator Burdick very clearly outlined, directly to the services that will help lower-income seniors before their circumstances force them into Medicaid eligibility. It speaks to that sense of fairness. So I would respectfully ask you that you support these changes in this particular deduction, but to also earmark the revenue benefits for some forward-thinking undertakings to reduce future state expenditures. And if we really do have to declare reverse conflicts of interest, I would be more than happy to give up my current exemption. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions or comments for this panel? You must have been extremely thorough. I understand the issue well enough so that I never know for sure. Representative Gelser.
Thank you. And there's a difference between the two bills in terms of the amount of revenue that they would generate. The first 2069 $23 million and then $43.3 million in 2461. If we went the route of 2461 and were able to fund the $30 million that's in 2391, would you be open to using some of that additional revenue to address the same problem for younger Oregonians who are also forced to give up everything that they have, sometimes including the custody of their children, in order to access basic medical services?
Well, the approach to long-term care, Mr. Chair, please. Representative Gelzer, I don't do this side very well, do I?
None of us do.
The approach to long-term care issues has included seniors and people with physical disabilities. People with physical disabilities are actually currently eligible for Oregon Project Independence funding, but there hasn't been enough money there to do it. So there are a number of ways we can get at expanding the system. I'm open to any conversation. In fact, I have not worked this bill further than to just get it introduced, because I'm very open to continued conversation about how it could be adapted depending on the revenue that's available. I will tell you that we just got numbers that were delivered to my office yesterday that say that the senior property tax deferral program that's currently funding OPI, or Oregon Project Independence, will zero out this year. We have no way to continue that program if we don't do something for it. And it's important because that focuses on the pre-Medicaid population. So there are two questions here. One of them is continuing an appropriate level of services in our Medicaid-eligible population, and I know there are a number of folks in the room today who are very concerned about that as well, as we all are when we go through our budget process. But then the secondary question is, how do we start addressing individuals at whatever age before they reach Medicaid eligibility? And so I think there's a lot of room for conversation.
Can I follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Gelzer.
Thank you. I think I was specifically speaking of individuals under the age of 19 who are still living with their families, where the families have to quit their jobs, get a divorce, lose absolutely everything they have just to be able to get medical care for their kids, because even if they have insurance, that insurance doesn't cover the needs of their kids, and they're not eligible for any assistance, because we say if you are a young person and you have a child, it's your responsibility to take care of this all on your own. So I guess if there is that additional revenue, if we went with the second, would you be open, and do you think the advocates would be open, given that we have this enormous subsidy to one segment of the population, to bringing this to the other, to whom in this state we offer basically nothing?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gelzer, I think that's a conversation that we could have. I wouldn't want to make any commitments at this particular juncture, because I think it has been generally discussed that what are many of us consider excessive subsidies to the wealthier seniors need to be reprogrammed into services for lower income seniors. We can certainly open the conversation. I don't know if this is the right vehicle or not, but as you well know, I share your concerns for the other population as well.
And Mr. Chair, if I could just add to that, I think when you talk about the population that you're talking about, Representative Gelzer, I think this is not a good structure for delivering help to those people. You know, the tax deduction is not a good structure, simply for the same reason that it's not a good structure for delivering benefits even to low-income seniors, frankly. So, but I think the net effect of this, especially 2471, and, you know, if it were repealed altogether, in most states, I think all states, I think we're the only state that has this, as I recall. So we wouldn't be, you know, we're kind of an outlier on that anyway. But I think what the net effect in a very, very difficult budget year would be to have more revenue on the table. And I think it's only fair, given the way seniors are being treated right now in the governor's budget, I think it's only fair to take the benefits from this particular medical deduction and funnel it to senior programs, because they are very, very needy. But it will also reduce the pressure on the budget overall. And I think the things that you're talking about are very worthy.
And may I follow up?
Please,
with one
yes.
more? Thank you. And And I agree that we have a challenging budget, and I believe it's unconscionable what we look at happening, particularly to our frail and low-income elderly seniors. But in that same budget, we are removing the very few supports that exist for that other population of children. And I think beyond this, beyond who pays, is a basic question of fairness. And I think in that sense of fairness, is it fair that from our general fund budget, we are spending tens of millions of dollars to subsidize wealthy seniors while we have other people that lose everything, either because they are adults that are pre-Medicaid, as Representative Cowan talks about, or because they happen to have a child with a profound disability, and as a result, the siblings can't go to college, they can't have a job, they don't have enough food on the table because they must live in poverty. So I think if you look at it from this basic sense of fairness, my goal would not be to move into Representative Cowan's bill these services. I think that's clearly a vehicle for one particular piece. But if there are additional revenues, I think that given that the policy question here was around medical service, not moving it into a tax credit, but moving it into a direct program that can provide those same services to what is a much lower income population that does not have guaranteed access to health care, which our elderly population does. These children often are going out without health care altogether. So I think there's a basic unfairness in our state where we have overlooked children, and particularly these. So I hope that we can consider, if we're able to pay for the services in Representative Cowan's bill, directing some of those immediately to those children, even though those children aren't currently paying, because their parents are when they place their kids into foster care because they can't get help because they are subsidizing these wealthy seniors in this other place. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, it frustrates me because the injustice that these families face is overwhelming. And I know that these two folks share that concern.
Right. And it's interesting, if I may just note, that one of the reasons we're having this particular conversation is that our structure as a legislature doesn't really allow for a conversation in which a part of the budget is represented by a tax provision, and another piece of the budget is represented by expenditures from revenues. And so we're in an awkward spot where this committee is responsible for the piece involving a tax expenditure and the generation of revenues, and a different joint committee is responsible for the budget. So as we pursue these particular kinds of discussions, not just this one, but other discussions similar to this one, we will be having these awkward conversations where the conversation which isn't particularly germane to the bill takes place anyway, because there's no forum in the legislature where these discussions can logically take place together. And so I suspect that we'll be having conversations like this one in this committee, and I suspect that the same thing will be happening in the Ways and Means Committee, where they will be talking about tax issues which aren't particularly in their purview, simply because we don't have a place where the conversation can take place together. And I just wanted to and we have more people to be heard, but I just wanted to add to Senator Burdick's comment, because I believe that it's absolutely correct to think about this as a budgetary expenditure that we happen to do through the tax system. And if you want to make a logical sense of the way we spend our money, this one does not make sense when you compare it to the budgets that we have available for dealing with other people who happen to have medical expenses and are ill.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Cowan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to expand on that a little bit, that I think while some of these references may be a bit clumsy in with reference to the way our system currently works, that's why you'll see, particularly in 2069, there's a direction around putting the revenue in the senior and disabled services account. In House Bill 2391, there's a direction to deposit the money in the Oregon Project Independence Fund, where there's some more flexibility. And it's the reason that although I like the amount of revenue generated by 2471, I like some of the methodologies in the other one and why I suggested that some combination of the two might be workable. But I think a number of folks are recognizing that challenge within our structure and our system and sort of trying to direct these funds into the most logical place where they should be bolstering other services. But to find that particular methodology is a challenge. So thank you for recognizing that.
Thank you very much. And, I, of course, that particular item, which is on page 5, lines 15 through 18, essentially does give instruction, doesn't it, to the Ways and Means Committee, but by depositing funds in that account. The Ways and Means Committee still has the responsibility of allocating the funds from that account, but it essentially earmarks it for things that are related to senior disabled services.
I think that's people's goals, Mr. Chair, and
right.
Whether or not this is the appropriate way to do it,
well,
I would yield to the good senator who wrote it that way.
But you simply pointed out, I think, that this is a way in which we can have the more general discussion here, if it were established in that way. Further questions for Representative Vance?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Senator, Representative, I always get a little confused on these adjustment to deductions, and the conversation has moved kind of how to use the money in the event that the legislation passes. But perhaps you could, either of you, address the original thinking that allowed everybody to deduct that 7.5%. Because obviously the federal government thinks that we should only be able to deduct that amount in excess of the 7.5%. The state somehow felt some years ago that folks should be able to deduct the 7.5%. That thinking, what was going on there? I know there was a reference to the PERS, but there had to be some thought that there was a rationale basis for doing that. And I just would like your thoughts on why at one point it was good and now in this, and I don't want to go to the spending half. I just want to focus on that.
Mm-hmm. Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Bentz, I think it's always good to give anybody a tax credit. This is a very popular one, and people really like it. But in answer to your question, as I understand it, this tax deduction, not a credit, but the deduction, came into being during the discussion. There was several years of discussion over how to tax state retirement benefits, PERS benefits. And for a while, we gave a kind of a refund to PERS retirees. That wasn't seen as fair to federal retirees. There was a lawsuit. And during all this, there were many efforts to see how we could compensate PERS retirees for the fact that we had started taxing them on their benefits. And this was part of that package as something to mitigate the effect on PERS retirees of taxing their benefits. So it really wasn't a senior program at the time, as I understand it. And Paul Warner has the institutional memories over there cringing. I think I've probably distorted some of the facts, but I think I have the broad outlines of it. It wasn't so much a senior program as it was a program to try to make things right with the PERS retirees.
Mr. Chair, if I could tag on to that just a bit, Representative Bentz, I'm newer to this process, so I don't have that historical perspective as much as the conversation I think it's important to focus on is how much things have changed in the interim period of time as well. And I don't think that, at least from my perspective, it would be difficult for me to believe that a great deal of thought was given to the demographic changes that we were facing and this tremendous growth in the over 65 population that we're now looking at. So as responsible legislators at this point, I think it's important that we look at the impacts of that growth and this unchecked deduction and where that's going to drive state budget revenues if we don't do something about it. So getting a little bit of a handle on it now is probably as important as fully understanding all of the historical perspective.
And Mr. Chair, I have to constantly remind myself that the impact of a tax deduction or a tax credit is basically to put a certain, the people who benefit from that deduction or that credit in a tough budget year, the effect of that credit is to put them at the front of the line, to basically, as we're making cuts and you know, really looking through all the programs we have and cut, the people who get these tax deductions and tax credits are held harmless. And I don't think we can afford to do that in this budget year, and I think that the policy itself is flawed in any budget year. But especially in this budget year, I don't think we can take a segment of our wealthiest people, and many of them live in my district, frankly. I don't think we can take that segment and put them at the head of the line and hold them harmless while we're making some of the other cuts that we are going to be forced to make in this budget.
Thank you.
Just to follow up, Mr. Chair, the what I'm trying to get at is the... And I appreciate both answers, but I'm trying to focus on just that 7.5% and the rationale that must have been in play, not necessarily the PERS issue, but...
Perhaps we could ask Paul or Chris to research that a little bit and maybe come back with what the legislature was thinking about at the time. I don't think any of us in the room really know. None of the rest of us were here then. I am aware that in 1986, the federal government, when it passed the so-called Tax Simplification Act, which, of course, was the opposite, went from a 3% deduction against medical expenses to the 7.5%, and 5 years later, the state of Oregon took this step. And I suspect those are related, though I don't know that for a fact. But you may have a different question you want to ask.
Yes, I was just trying to... I'll try to get to the point more rapidly. The issue is people are allowed to deduct medical expenses, and there must be a reason for that. And my question is, why should we allow anyone to deduct any medical expense? That's my question.
Ah.
Oh, that's an excellent question, Mr. Chair and Representative Bentz. I think I would assume that the reason that the 7.5% was set the way it was a recognition that, you know, something over that level, whether it be 7.5% or 10% or whatever, is an extraordinary expense for anyone, and that's the only thing I can think of is but that's a federal, you know, that the 7.5% was a federal deduction that we connected to, so it really wasn't a decision made here in Oregon. The decision that was made here in Oregon was a decision to be the only state in the country that let you deduct from 0 to 7.5%, and then once you get over 7.5%, you can deduct them anyway under both federal and state law.
Yeah, I think it would be very helpful if we ask staff to prepare for us a sheet with several examples on it of what happens with the federal deduction and that we are tied to, and with the state deduction. Now, these bills do not address the federal deduction we're tied to at all. So that stays in place no matter what we do with these bills, unless there was a huge amendment of some kind. But I think it would be really helpful to for the committee to understand how this actually works in the real life for people. And I'm thinking, for example, you take a low-income person who has modest medical expenses or who has extremely high medical expenses in a given year, middle-income person in the same two situations, and a high-income person in the same two situations, and sort of look at what the effects are of the federal rule that we're tied to and the effect of this particular rule that we're talking about. I have done that, and I think it actually helps a lot to understand what the real effect of this particular deduction is. And frankly, for me, that's the reason why we're hearing these bills, is that the effect of these deductions are kind of strange when you examine them in the real world, and the way they actually affect real people with their actual situations that they face. And I believe, and I hope, and I suspect that a description of what actually occurs would help to would explain this. I believe that this change is quite a bit more benign than it might appear on first blush. Because of the way these two deductions interact with each other, and the way people's incomes and tax situation interact with their actual medical expenses. Now, I don't know if that helps for today, but...
That is the point.
Yeah, and I think that would be very helpful for us if we could get staff to make to generate some examples and then describe how these laws interact with each other for individuals. We've been focusing on our budget issue, and that's basically where you were focusing. I think Representative Bent's question is, but what about how this affects an individual taxpayer? And I think we ought to examine that.
That's it.
Okay. Thank you. Other questions for this panel? We do have another panel. Thank you very much.
We
appreciate your bringing these bills and your hard work on in connection with them, and we'll see where we go.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for having the hearing.
Thank you. Now, these three,
Chair,
I don't... Yes,
Representative Gelson. Before I leave, could I just thank Representative Cowan for the extraordinary work that she's done to try to address the systemic issues on that other side? I mean, she's just been such a champion on these issues, and we should listen to her about these issues.
And I expect she'll continue to be.
I think so.
That's right. Well, we have three more people signed up, and I'm going to call them up at the same time, although I know they don't represent precisely the same point of view at all. Ralph Groner, Rick Bennett, and Jody Weiser. And it looks like we need another chair.
Last. I'll just sit here.
Okay. Ralph.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Ralph Groner. I represent American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. I've learned a lot today, so I feel like, wow, should I be quiet? Because I started lobbying in 91, and I don't even recall this. However, in 75, I don't care about this so much, but I did chair the aging committee that wrote Project Independence. And so I have a special interest, I guess, in that project no longer having funds. Just a few thoughts. I really appreciate the comments everyone's made, because I was caught by surprise on a few facts inside that as from this. I would say, however, I'd miss an opportunity, if you don't mind, to say I went to Lane Shetterly, the chair of the Governor's Commission, after I listened to George Naughton, as you did, and you did, on the Governor's Commission on tax reform, tell us that we face a crisis in just a few years regarding the cost of long-term care. I took that serious, and the chair of the Governor's Commission said I could go ahead and work on it, and I continued. Ultimately, it led me to Paul Warner, because Lane said back in some year he had a measure in front of him, and it must have been this, that was looked at, and I went to Paul, and he finally said it's going to probably cost us $127 million in next biennium for this program. So my simplistic, I'm being honest with you all, thought was, well, why don't we cap, like we did with the Oregon Health Plan, the amount we could deduct. I don't want to pay for a total new heart, because then we'll only have 10 people get help rather than thousands. And second was, why don't we just allow this for lower and middle income folks, not the wealthy, to use as a tax measure, and primarily because my goal was to find money, as I've been working on measures for alcohol and drug, by the way, heavily, door-to-door, nearly every legislator. It's a wonder the Oregonian hasn't named me the enemy on the beer tax, but I've also been working on other tax expenditures that I think that are even more egregious than this might be, in terms of corporate and the $10 minimum, et cetera. But I won't get into those right now. I will later. Tax on the wealthy, et cetera. I will say this, just the bottom line, the wonderful work that Representative Cowan has done, it may be said in a different way. We have two crises in our budgets, beyond recessions. the cost of long-term care, and I am not a conflict of interest because I have passed by several years the baby boomer class. By that, I mean I'm out past it. So I no longer am even part of the baby boomer class at age 67, almost 68. So the fact of the matter is I do care so much about, one, our budget, and I'm always working, as the Speaker of the House told me, you're never going to get a sales tax in Oregon. You're not going to get a gross receipts tax, Groner. You're not going to get anything you've worked for since 1973 on this committee. So, frankly, you better just find dedicated funds to fund the things you care. So if you don't think I'm off my rocker, the fact is you'll see me on specific taxes working, because we don't have a comprehensive tax system in Oregon that allows us to talk intelligently. And the fact is we're forced to go to special taxes just to fund things to save money. So what we're really talking about here is whether it's this program or another. If you were to just put this money into the general fund, I think you need to cap it and make this a lower income and lower middle income program. I wasn't even aware it was for the wealthy. That's what I approached Paul on some time ago, back before bills were drafted. Ironically, there were two groups working on this simultaneously, and the other one I thought you should cap. And the reason was to, one, the amount of baby boomers. The President Bush wouldn't sign the White House Conference on Aging. I sent letters, wrote my congressman for the deduction on long-term care for the younger people here. The fact is you're going to face long-term care without insurance, and it ought to be deducted as part of your Medicare deduction. That hopefully now will occur, but in Oregon we have no such program. So what we have are the baby boomers entering long-term care, and at one program that has proven with legislative fiscal that for every dollar you spend, it's about $4 you saved in by home health care, food, transportation at the home. So that's Project Independence. And I was told by the AAAs that if we had $30 million dedicated funds, we could save, if you will take that, I was really looking at prevention, how we can save dollars and keep them out of the more costly long-term care for those that's appropriate. In the meantime, I have a hard time on this one. We just lost, in the governor's budget, 477 of my caseworkers. The caseworkers come from Multnomah County, all my members. They come from the five-county area, all my members. All the five-county on the coast, all my members. Lane County, all my members, 477 caseworkers. Lest we don't think there's a major crisis dealing with the elderly. Those were cut from the budget. Those are the folks that handle your mom and dad or you coming to them to direct what kind of care is appropriate. One of the care might be home health care. On the other hand, it might be adult foster care. On the other hand, it might be assisted living. On the other hand, it might be a nursing home. Those are your categories. One's more costly necessarily than the other, and I'm trying to keep people in their home as long as we can, to have staff who are the knowledgeable, highly trained people who know how to do that, and they're now gone by the end of June in this current budget. And so I see a major crisis, not only in our, I would hope George Naughton comes in front of you and says what he did to the governor's commission that you were on, Mr. Chair, in that you face the major crisis he talked about to us was the long-term care crisis. So I'm not here to talk the pros and cons of the bill, but we need to do something. And if money is just going to go into the general fund, look what happened to the seniors on the property. We don't have Project Independence funding. That means we don't have prevention dollars. This is not a Democrat or a Republican issue. It is an issue in behalf of the elderly, and it's an issue in behalf of all of you, and it's an issue in behalf of the legislature and the governor, and it's an issue for the state of Oregon. So I hope I didn't speak too loudly or too long. I probably did. I feel very strongly that this is not just an emotional issue. This is a crisis that we face that we must come to grips with this session. Thank you.
Thank you, Ralph. Questions for Ralph. You made your point. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yes. Mr. Bennett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Rick Bennett, representing AARP. Over the past couple of years, I've had a number of conversations with both you and other legislators, legislative staff, and advocates related to what is commonly referred to as the senior medical deduction. However, in those 2 years, I've managed to avoid actually being at the table here on the record and having that conversation. Apparently, whatever skills I have or luck have failed me today.
I think it is your handwriting here, if I recognize it.
Yeah, yes, it is. Although I think Ralph was starting to write my name when I was standing there. I have just a few comments to make related to both House Bills 2069 and 2471. First, just a little bit related to AARP policy. I've distributed to you our principles on taxation. Those principles are guidelines for us in weighing any particular tax measure or tax credit for that matter. The one principle I would draw your attention to is equity, indicating that tax revenue sources should distribute the tax burden according to people's ability to pay and should, to the extent possible, achieve vertical and horizontal equity. Vertical equity means that the tax burdens, the percentage of income paid in taxes, should increase with a measure of ability to pay, usually income. Horizontal equity holds that those of equal resources should be taxed equally. And that horizontal equity piece is particularly relevant here related to the age, 62 and above, having access to this deduction, and those younger than 62 not having access to it. Mr. Chairman, you referred to the Federal Tax Reform Act of 1986 that increased the medical expense deduction from, I believe, 5% to 7.5% of the adjusted gross income. And AARP felt that the older and sicker taxpayers who itemize their deduction bear the brunt of this increase because of their higher out-of-pocket expenses for medical care. And based on our policy, we would hope that Congress, if they were to look at that threshold, would lower the medical expense deduction threshold of adjusted gross income for all taxpayers. Similarly, I would say that Oregon senior medical deduction, I would suggest that that certainly now, even more so than in 1991, all of us are facing much higher medical expenses, and if you were interested in providing some assistance or benefit, that you should do so for all citizens, and not just those at 62 or 65, or, with my membership, only those who are 50 and older. And I suspect if you looked at House Bill 2471 and kind of the graduated type of benefit there, that might be a way to do that. I'm not sure whether, in fact, you could actually remove the age requirement and have it revenue neutral. But frankly, that would be an option I'd be interested in seeing you do, because, like I say, I think all of us are having difficulty with medical expenses these days. Now, the reality is, having passed this deduction in 1991 and many people having used the benefit for a number of years now, making a change is always difficult. And it is along those lines that I've had a number of conversations with individuals, and I've suggested that if you did want to make a change in this deduction, modest or otherwise, that, in fact, it probably would be helpful if you took the dollars that are recaptured by that change and retarget them for other benefits to seniors and people with disabilities. And clearly, House Bill 2069 does exactly that. I think, overall, the change you're making as far as the amount of the deduction is fairly modest. I believe, if I read it correctly, it has some index for that $6,000 changing over time, I believe, and it has a calculation for determining what those dollars are as far as recaptured each year. So, and depositing those dollars in a specific account, So in fact, you know, the dollars don't gradually just fade into general fund and so forth. And so I think House Bill 2069 certainly is in keeping with everything that I've said privately over the last 2 years. So under normal circumstances, I would certainly not oppose this and would be generally supportive. But these are not normal circumstances. We're certainly going to be facing in the 2009-11 budget at least a $2.5 billion shortfall. We're looking at significant cuts in programs, not only for seniors and people with disabilities, but in all of our state programs, in education, public safety, health care and assistance for young and old alike. And I believe we're also trying to, whatever dollars we do have, certainly for human services, trying to maximize the federal matching funds that are available to us, and particularly now with the stimulus package, it even increases that match. So one of my concerns is not related to the bills you're hearing today, but to how those monies that are recaptured might be spent. Representative Cowan has referenced House Bill 2391 that makes a $30 million appropriation and is fairly specific as far as how those dollars will be spent. In addition to Oregon Project Independence, it makes a $3.9 million appropriation for a central information center, $11.8 million for staffing of local assistance centers, the $10.5 million for direct services of OPI, $2.1 million to expand caregiving support, and $1.7 million to establish programs for chronic disease management. Now, all of these programs and services are ones that AARP has and continues to support. They're also identified by the Campaign for Seniors and People with Disabilities as programs that we need to move forward on, if not now, sometime in the future, and they're all mentioned in the comprehensive plan that the Division for Seniors and People with Disabilities has developed in accordance with Senate Bill 1061 from the February session. However, again, as I said, we're facing rather extraordinary circumstances, and right now I could not say to you that this is the best use of $30 million. Or whatever the number of dollars that these bills might generate. When I look at the budget reductions proposed in the governor's budget, the significant reductions in in-home care, the reimbursement rates for facilities, which might mean that some facilities will cancel their contracts for Medicaid. I mean, it just goes on and on. And frankly, when we're trying to sustain the basic needs and services that we're providing, I'm just not sure if new initiatives are the way we want to go right now. The other thing I might mention as well is that just as advocates for seniors and people with disabilities are interested in developing additional funds for these programs, you have mental health advocates who are interested in increasing the tax on beer to fund their programs. I suspect that individuals supportive of state troopers would also like to see some of those dollars support their efforts, and it goes on and on to some extent with tobacco tax and so forth. And frankly, I think the crisis we're facing really needs to be looked at in a much broader sense. Again, as I indicated, we're facing significant cuts in all programs. I know my members, certainly they're very concerned about providing assistance and care to our older citizens, but they're also very concerned about education programs for their adult children and their grandchildren. They're concerned about public safety. They want to make sure that their roads are safe and that individuals who commit crimes are kept in prison. And so I would ask you, I understand that there's good reason to look at this particular deduction, but I would ask you as you do your work to really focus on more broad-based solutions for what faces us. And with that, I'll end my comments and answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions for Mr. Bennett? A very thorough review.
Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen, very much. Jody?
For the record, Jody Weiser with Tax Credits Oregon. I love the discussion that's happening on this panel this year. It's you interact more than you have in the past. It feels more deliberative. And that happened with these two bills today. I agree with Senator Burdick. We really should eliminate this program entirely. And maybe a group can get together and work to do that. It's outrageous, the law that we have in place. Somebody with $2 million worth of income can deduct $150,000 worth of medical expenses now, which could be the medical expenses of their 40-year-old partner. And neither of these bills really addresses the fact that these medical expenses can be anybody in the family's medical expenses, not the medical expenses of a senior citizen. So I think there are good, if you're going to go with just cutting the program back somewhat rather than eliminating it entirely, I think there are good elements to each bill, and a work group makes good sense. The effective date of 2009 rather than 2010 is a hunk of money that we could have at our disposal in this dire times. Both bills continue to benefit families that are well above average for our state. My calculation is, if I'm right, that if you could deduct $6,000 worth of medical expenses, that would be 7.5% of an AGI of $80,000. Well, that's about two times the median household income in this state. So we're talking about still benefiting people who are two times as wealthy as most families in the state. And while there's way less benefit with under 2471, we're still providing benefit to families that are roughly three times as wealthy as the median family in the state. And it doesn't really make sense to be doing that just because of age. I also think that it is harder for you to operate when you have more things dedicated to programs, and I've been surprised that we're still hearing bills to create new programs when we have no idea how we're going to fund the ones we have. And my final comment is simply, you know, there's another benefit in our tax code that is there just because you're a certain age, and that's the $1,000 that you get for being 65. And I think I would hope that this committee will look at that as something we should be considering, if that's really one of our highest values in the state at this time or not. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Questions for Jody? Thank you very much. We appreciate your continued participation with the work of the committee.
Thank you.
Thank you. Colleagues, we're in public hearing, but I think it would be very useful if members have any additional comments they want to make today. I think this is one of those puzzles that as we look at the future, and I've asked Chris to give us some additional information based on demographics of what the effect of this deduction will be on the state's revenue over the next decade or so. One of the things you can do pretty easily, because we know what the age cohorts are, is make estimates of what the effect on the state's revenue will be. I think that will be very eye-opening to the committee, because this thing gets very large very fast if we don't do something to rein it in. And that's an additional comment on top of the ones that have been made by our witnesses today. Any other comments that people would like to make? Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just in general, one of the things that I think we need to seriously look at are not only this deduction and other deductions, but other credits as well. We as it was pointed out, this puts certain people or groups to the front of the line simply by giving them the deduction or credit up front without any way for us to deliberate on whether this is the best use of our scarce dollars or not. And I think we need to look at that very seriously.
Thank you. Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is building on what Representative Riley said. I was struck by that phrase of putting this group of people or any group of people when we do a tax credit or a tax deduction to the front of the line. And there are certainly places where tax credits or tax deductions are good. I mean, it is a way that we can incentivize behavior. Sometimes it's a way to better deliver services or have something happen in the community that we can do more efficiently than through the expenditure side. But what gets lost when we get into situations like we're in right now with our budget and we talk about everyone sharing the pain and across the board budget reductions, we are all right now deliberating on how to fill this hole, $800 million, $1 billion, and the next biennium, $1 billion or $2 billion, with all of our agencies submitting their cut lists of up to 5%. And I think we would all agree that there are essential services on there that we're going to have to vote to cut this biennium, that we support and understand how important they are. But I submit that we aren't all coming to the table and it isn't all being shared equally, because we have this giant book of many very worthy things in the tax expenditures, but they are held completely harmless in a situation like this. There is no reduction list. There is no request for prioritization when it comes to our tax expenditures. And I wish there was a way that we could look at those hydraulics, because if we could, I think we could lessen the impact on some of our vital programs and services and better understand which are the vital tax credits and deductions that we have in our tax expenditure book, because some of them are. But we never have the chance to discuss that in the situation. And so, in fact, these things do go to the very front of the line. And it's frustrating when you look at all of the things that Oregonians will be losing and the danger that seniors face, the poor face, our children face with their schools letting out early this year.
Representative Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the discussion today, and it falls on the discussion we had 2 years ago regarding the same issue. I'm struck now, as I was then, by how massively regressive this current, the way we deduct for senior medical expenses is now. A simple example would be a $10,000 heart procedure for somebody who makes $20,000 a year versus a $10,000 heart procedure for somebody who makes $1 million a year. And because we're talking deductions and not credits, obviously it's clearly regressive. Having said that, And so I put that in the preface that I would agree in general that something has to be done with this tax deduction, the current medical senior medical tax deduction for Oregon. I'm a little bit concerned, though, without necessarily a clear direction on how to satisfy it, but a little bit concerned with some of the details in 2471 itself, though, that we are doing a hard and fast cap at $50,000, which seems like a fairly extreme ratchet down from where we are now. And as I think most of us have seen through experience, when you do these sorts of things, it's generally the market takes it better, if you will, the public take it better if you phase down or phase in rather than just have a cliff effect. And I'm also concerned, once again, with the way the bill's written, in that it is using hard and fast numbers rather than any sort of inflation-adjusted measure. This may be a value this year. 10 years from now, it will have much less. It will be worth much less 10 years from now. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Bruin. Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I enjoyed the conversation also. The part that didn't quite come out that I was hoping in my question was the nature of the deduction, which is why would we allow anyone to write off a medical expense? And, of course, the answer would be that the government at some point felt that money that you spent on medical expenses is something that shouldn't be counted against income, because the idea is to fix yourself and get back to work, and you've lost that. Why should we tax you on that, which you needed to get back to work? It's a tough argument when you're over 65 or 70 or when you're not working. But to me, you'd have to go to, in order to, the conversation slides over into needs when I would like to focus on the original idea of why the deduction to begin with. Mm-hmm. Because if you can focus on that, then it makes it far simpler to make the adjustments that Representative Bruin is talking about, because then you understand why we had the thing to begin with. Now, that federal government obviously made some sort of choice at 7.5%, everything below it, you couldn't. And to me, that's kind of an interesting, looking there to find out what the thinking was might be of some help. But that's the starting point. But the goods and the needs, those are clear, and those are apparent. And that prompts the further review on why the deduction to begin with and how much.
Thank you, Representative Vance. Others today? Colleagues, I believe we're going to continue having these kinds of conversations. We have other discussions coming up on other aspects of this. I wish we could have a really free-floating sort of general conversation about that, as Representative Gelster has suggested. I think the tax codes are complex enough so that that conversation, except in the context of a bill like the one we heard the other day involving sunsets on tax credits, is unlikely. But I also am very mindful of Mr. Bennett's comment that if I get it right, I hope I do, that a larger discussion, a more general discussion, makes sense, especially given the situation that Oregon finds itself in today. And I take that to heart, and I will do what I can to help generate that kind of a more general discussion. Colleagues, as those of us who were here in 2002 and in 2003 have a little inkling of the horrible difficulty that we face as we try to write a budget, both to finish out this biennium and another budget for the next biennium. I have to say that it is a chamber of horrors that we face. What anything we can do that is reasonable and appropriate that will help ameliorate that problem, we should do. I appreciate the discussion this morning. Anything else? Thank you very much. With that, we are adjourned.